I'm Rick Ganley. This is NHPR News at 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today on The Exchange, and here are some of the voices you heard this week on NHPR.
My pledge to voters here, if I'm nominated and elected, I will not toe the party line when our state, our nation, and our Constitution will be weakened. I will not get sucked in by business-as-usual politics. I will not be beholden to Beltway, go-along, get-along that has dragged our nation deeper into debt and eroded our liberties.
A women's prison is totally inadequate now, and I believe it isn't even safe. And so I'll be really pleased when we have a new women's prison up in Concord.
Probably about 15 million acres of New England was impacted by the storm, and that's about 35% of the area. So that's a pretty large area.
So we're talking millions upon millions of trees.
That's right, yeah. And, you know, in Cheshire County, overnight, probably 25% of the land was impacted.
We're doing relatively well, but at the same time, it is a double-edged sword in that it can sort of lead officials or state leaders to think that poverty is sort of not a problem in the state at all.
We know that what we've designed and what we're offering will not please or meet the exact needs of every potential purchaser. And I feel that a business developing a product could never meet the needs of 100% of potential purchasers.
That was former State Senator Jim Rubens, Executive Counselor Deborah Pignatelli, Cheshire County Extension Forester Steve Roberge, UNH researcher Jessica Carson, and Anthem President Lisa Girton. As head of the state's largest health insurer and the only participant in the Affordable Care Act's new health exchanges, Girton faced tough questions this week from state senators, criticizing her company's plan to lower costs through a narrower network of hospitals and providers. When the network was unveiled, those communities whose hospitals were not included were pretty upset, and state senators reiterated those concerns in a meeting with Anthem. But Girton said most Granite Staters will still be close enough to one of its approved providers, and she also suggested that we all may have to learn to live with a little disruption in order to control costs. Again, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange, and we'll cover these stories and many others. Let's hear from you, too. Your thoughts about some of these headlines and more. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us a short email, the address exchange@nhpr.org, or post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. Joining me for the roundup this week are Norma Love, State House reporter for the Associated Press. Norma, welcome back. Good to see you.
Good morning, Laura.
Also with us, Ben Lubsdorf, staff reporter at the Concord Monitor, covering New Hampshire politics and state government. And Ben, welcome back to you too. Thanks for your time.
Good morning, Laura.
And as always, Dean Spiliotis is here, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, author of the website, nhpoliticalcapital.com. And Dean, happy Friday. Good to see you.
Hi. Good morning, Laura.
Well, and all of you, let's start with that Anthem story, because that really did seem to dominate headlines last week. And this week, more fallout, Dean, from this announcement that the exchanges will be based on a narrower network of providers. Just back up for a minute, Dean. What's this all about?
Sure. Well, the Affordable Care Act, usually known as Obamacare, requires all individuals to purchase health insurance. If you don't buy health insurance, you're subject to a fine. The same is true for employers with full-time workers. So part of the act sets up these health care exchanges or marketplaces in each state. States can do it on their own. They can allow they can leave it to the federal government to do it, or they can do it in conjunction. We're in this sort of middle hybrid where we're working with the federal government to set up these exchanges. This starts on October 1st. Right now, we only have Anthem as an option in the exchange. Now, Anthem says they're going to offer 11 different options depending on what kind of deductible you want, what kind of co-pays you want, et cetera, et cetera. So there will be some choice within the context of the one provider.
Sure, it isn't just
right.
One plan. There's 11
right.
Plans from bronze to gold.
Right, that's right. And but the issue is the narrow network. They've removed 10 hospitals from their standard coverage. You know, their argument is the way they're able to keep this affordable is to negotiate lower rates with the hospitals in exchange for guaranteeing the hospitals a larger patient population so that the hospitals can make it viable. If you put some of those other hospitals back in, then you're spreading the patient population around. That makes the whole balance of rates versus patients out of whack. And that's essentially what the company president said to the senators the other day.
Well, and Ben, you were at that meeting with state senators. What happened? What did some of the state senators say to Anthem officials, including Lisa Gerton?
Well, this was billed as a briefing on the new plans that Anthem's going to be offering, not only through the exchange, but also for individual customers buying outside the exchange. Folks at certain income levels will get subsidies from the federal government to buy through the exchange. At other income levels, they won't have that available, so their prices will be higher. And Lisa Gerton, the president of Anthem, gave a presentation that was defending their decisions. And then she got the questions. And the questions really united the political spectrum. You had more than half the Senate there, Republicans who don't like Obamacare at all, Democrats who do like Obamacare and want, for example, to expand Medicaid as part of that, and they all hate this. They were all very critical of the Anthem plan to narrow the network. Some folks, Sam Cataldo, who's a Republican senator, was saying that he recently got knee surgery, and they excluded the two hospitals that provide that service from their network, so you can't get that covered now. Meanwhile, Betty Lasky, a Democratic senator, was saying that in Nashua, they picked the hospital that doesn't provide full reproductive health services, St.
They
Joe's.
They picked the Catholic hospital,
yes.
Yeah.
And so you've got people on opposite ends of the political spectrum all very critical about this plan to exclude certain hospitals, 10 hospitals in all in the state, from this narrow network. The problem is that it's not clear that the Senate can do anything about this. Lisa Gerton made clear that they don't want to add more hospitals in at this point. They added two more in when this was announced in the North Country. But it's like the way she describes it, it's like stacking a bunch of dishes in a dryer. You add one more and the whole thing could collapse. You add more hospitals in and the hospitals that are already in there could say, well, now we're going to get fewer patients than you promised. Then these lower rates, reimbursement rates you're offering don't make sense for us at all.
That's the calculation the dean was talking about. These hospitals signed on saying, okay, this is, you know, these are lower rates, but presumably we'll have more people.
And the worry that Lisa Gerton was explaining is that if you add a second hospital in Nashua, then some of the hospitals in the North Country might pull out. Then you have a geographic gap. You don't have coverage in one part of the state, and you have double coverage in another part of the state.
Well, here's an email from Casey in Portsmouth that just came in on this issue, and I'll throw this to you, Ben, since you were there. Casey says, I don't understand the fuss about the exchange plans limiting some medical choice. Private insurance of all stripes has always had preferred networks. If my doctor was outside that network, I could still see that person but would pay more out of pocket. This is not new. Casey says, this just seems like another red herring to discredit the health reform law. What do you think, Ben? You were saying people on both sides of this health reform law don't like what Anthem's done.
Well, and it's true. There have always been HMOs and networks, at least in the last few decades, that have limited, had networks that you get better rates on when you stay inside the network. I think the difference here is that if you have Anthem today, and this won't change for most people, the current network will stay in place for folks who get their insurance through their employer, folks like that. But you can go to Concord Hospital if you live in the Concord area. You can get a doctor through Concord Hospital. Now, if, say, you have that insurance, your employer drops it, you buy through the exchange, suddenly you don't have access to Concord Hospital anymore. You have to get a new doctor. Maybe you have to drive further to get to that doctor. And this was one concern that was raised at this meeting on Wednesday, is there going to be enough capacity within that narrow network for these new patients who would be coming in? Are there going to be delays in getting appointments? So I think that that's the disruption that Lisa Gerton was talking about. She says that we need this disruption if we're going to get the healthcare costs down. Other people aren't happy about it.
Yeah, Dean, and then Norma will hear from you too.
Yeah,
go ahead, Dean.
And this is the political problem. If you remember back to when they were debating the law in Congress, President Obama repeatedly said, if you have your doctor and you like your doctor, you can keep your doctor. And I think there's a sense, at least politically, and certainly Republicans see the opportunity to make the argument that this is really just the beginning of what is essentially a slippery slope to limiting your health care options, that in reality you're going to have fewer choices. You may not have to give up your doctor right now, but in a couple of years, some of these plans may go the same route and have a more narrow network for savings reasons, and that's problematic. So,
okay, well, here's the other side, though. I mean, for a long time, everybody's complained about cost. Everybody says healthcare costs are unsustainable. So here's Anthem, you know, and this is their perspective. Yeah. They're trying to reduce premiums in a pretty big way, 30% lower than they would have been without this narrower network. So, Ben Lubsdorf, you know, we talked earlier on the exchange on this idea of the exchanges, and one of our guests, Republican state rep from Ringe, said, look, if you want to lower costs, you might have to give something up. Did anybody in the state Senate see it Anthem's way?
I think that there is an acknowledgement that this is Anthem making a business decision to keep these costs down, to make these plans affordable. But I think you just got at one of the political issues with this, which is Anthem says these are 30% lower than they would have been otherwise. That's not compared to where they are now. They're looking at the introduction of people who have been in high-risk pools, for example. This was one thing Lisa Gertin said at this meeting, who are now going to be entering the individual marketplace. These people have higher health care costs than everyone else. That will drive up costs for everyone. So they're comparing what it would be, which I think for most people is different from comparing it to where you are now.
So, sure, you're not getting a cut immediately.
No, you may be actually seeing an increase in costs, but it's lower than it would have been otherwise. And I think that's more difficult for people to conceptualize than an actual cut in their rates.
Yeah, Norma, go ahead.
A couple of thoughts. One is when you talk hospital, you're not just talking about the hospital. You're talking about a network of doctors, because a lot of the hospitals in the state have essentially bought up practices. So like my doctor in Pinnacook is a doctor that is affiliated with Concord Hospital. So if you shut off...
So it's just about every doctor.
Yeah, so you shut off the hospital, you shut off a considerable area of medical services access. And the second thing is, I think it was Michael Green that put in an op-ed piece in Ben's paper talking about if we had taken this low rate, we would have lowered the bar for every other insurance company, every other negotiation we had, and it would become unsustainable for the hospital to take that rate. And I think there is some concern out there that that may be the way we're going. Narrow network, take it or leave it. And that's going to prove to be a tremendous disruption going forward. The other thing I'd like to say is that there is a connection to what's going on separately with the Medicaid expansion. I covered the Medicaid Expansion Commission this week, and they finally started talking about what they really thought, not in such terms that you would say, aha, this is what they're going to do, but there was agreement among six of the nine members that, yes, they believe that we should take the federal money and do something. What there was not total agreement on yet was how we would implement a plan. But it's clear that one of the things that they would like to do is use private insurance if they can, including the exchanges.
Okay, so these stories are tightly connected. All right.
Yes.
We will follow up after a short break. Speaking of insurance and the uninsured, Ben, you reported on some new numbers showing an increase in the number of uninsured Granite Staters. We'll talk about that coming up and take your calls at 1-800-892-6477. Keep it right here.
This is NHPR 919. Good morning. What's going on this week at NHPR? Well, an easy way for you to find out is when you sign up for our new e-newsletter, This Week at NHPR. You'll find out what the exchange, word of mouth, and our newsroom are planning for the week, and also get a behind-the-scenes look at the station. Click on the Connect menu to sign up for our e-newsletter at nhpr.org. Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and support also comes to us from Goose Bay Lumber Company of Chichester, Fine Hardwoods, Boat Lumber, Marine Plywood, and West System for boats, canoes, kayaks, and wood surfboards. GooseBayLumber.com. From AARP, presenting You've Earned a Say, a community discussion on solutions to keep Medicare and Social Security strong, inviting Granite Staters to join the conversation at aarp.org/NH. And Southern New Hampshire University's doctoral program in educational leadership for professionals ready to lead schools into the 21st century. snhu.edu/edd. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, and we're covering some of the major stories that made headlines this week. This includes more fallout over health insurance exchanges. Later on, we'll talk about next year's congressional elections and more people possibly jumping in there. Right now, though, I want to look at some new numbers that came out from the Census Bureau this week on poverty, on the number of uninsured people in New Hampshire. And Ben Loomstorff, you dug into the numbers in this morning's Concord Monitor. What'd you dig out?
Well, yesterday was kind of Christmas for data nerds. It was the release of the American Community Survey, which is the 3 million household poll that the Census Bureau does every year that shows real detailed data on states across the country. We'll get more detailed data for smaller communities later this year. But these numbers showed that New Hampshire is pretty well off, but not necessarily moving in the right direction. The number of uninsured folks in the state was 10.6%. That's up a tiny bit from 2011, when it was 10.5%. According to the ACS, the number of people living in poverty in New Hampshire was 10%. And earlier, a different study that was out earlier in the week showed New Hampshire at 8.1%. Either whichever set of numbers you look at, and they're both from the Census Bureau, New Hampshire's still the lowest rate in the country, the place where there's fewer people living in poverty than anywhere else. But it's also important to note that in the American Community Survey numbers, they're up from last year. It was 8.8% in 2011. Now it's 10%. That's one of only a couple of states that the Census Bureau says saw a statistically significant increase in poverty. So we're still very well off compared to the rest of the nation, but not necessarily going in the right direction.
What do you pull out of these numbers, Dean Spiliotis?
Yeah, well, it is interesting. You know, first of all, if you look at New Hampshire, say, in comparison to Mississippi, which I believe was at the opposite end of the spectrum at like 22% of 22% of the population in poverty. You know, I mean, these are statistically significant, but they are small. You know, we're having the healthcare debate right now about how to get these additional folks to have coverage. You know, one argument I hear from people sometimes is the reason why we have such a low poverty rate is because the state is not particularly well known for having a significant safety net. So the people who need the types of programs you get through a social safety net typically go to other states like Massachusetts. But, you know, the state job numbers we can talk about as well. We're at 5% in August, which is quite low. So, you know, there are some mixed signs here. But just, you know, in comparison, given that we just went through this great recession, in comparison to how a lot of other states are doing, New Hampshire doing reasonably well.
Well, with those unemployment numbers, too, I'm glad you mentioned
yeah.
that, Dean. It is Christmas for data nerds this week. Norma, what about the unemployment numbers? 5%? Pretty good, but there are places where we're doing well and places where we're not doing
well. I think you have to dig deeper into numbers. I mean, I tend to look at numbers skeptically because it's what you're counting, and what you're not counting matters too. So as they continually talk about in the national scene, how many people just stop looking for work? So you have to look at how many people are employed, how many people have just said, hey, I've tried and I can't find a job. But I want to go back for a second to the census numbers and that issue. I don't think people understand that one of the ways states get federal aid is by a lot of these statistical surveys and how they count and how they measure poverty and some of the other factors. And that will determine percentages that you get. For example, our Medicaid match is 50-50 in a lot of programs. Some states with higher poverty, higher number of poor people get a higher rate. So they get a bigger chunk of the taxpayer dollar. And I think going back for a second to the jobs report, you know, we've always had low numbers. But I'm not so sure, as Ben said, that it's necessarily reflecting a healthy economy.
Yeah, and I love what you said about it's not just what you're counting, it's what you're not counting. And that counts, too. So
right.
I appreciate that. We have an email that just came in. Again, more people chiming in on the health exchanges that we talked about earlier. This is from Rick. As a 53-year-old who cannot afford the $850 a month on the individual market now, the rates on the exchange will be much better, even without the 10 hospitals. I plan on signing up October 1st. So, Ben, again, there you have somebody saying, look, prices are going down, and I'm willing to sign up.
Well, and I think that this is where we're at with this exchange, where the argument that was made when this law was being passed at the national level and the argument that's being made now is that this is going to open up affordable health insurance to a lot of people who can't afford health insurance now, regardless of subsidy, regardless of income level. Folks are going to be able to buy health insurance at a much lower rate than they can now on really a very confusing individual market. And I think that that's not a bad thing. No one's actually arguing that's a bad thing. But I think it's the devil's in the details on a lot of this stuff. And I think that's where folks are complaining about these exchange plans, specifically the exclusion of places. The network, Anthem says that you're going to be able to drive to within 20 miles or 20 minutes or something like that. 90% of the folks who would be on these plans can do that. But at the same time, you had David Pierce, state senator, note on Wednesday that there's nothing in Sullivan County in this network.
Yeah, and the political problem that you mentioned earlier, Dean, is yes, costs may go down, but President Obama did say, if you like your doctor, you can keep him or her, and now we're learning that may
right.
not be
you know,
the case.
I think both sides, both parties would agree that the rollout has been rocky, and I think other aspects of the rollout of Obamacare over the next couple of years will continue to be rocky because there is this ongoing political debate. We just had the House vote once again. Now they want to link defunding the entire Obamacare legislation to whether or not to shut down the government, whether or not to raise the debt ceiling. So it's absolutely a political football. And fair or not, opponents of Obamacare are using some of these initial concerns and questions about the health exchanges as evidence that it's actually going to be less choice and cost more money.
All right. Well, again, the number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Rick, thanks for that email. You can email us as well, exchange@nhpr.org, or post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. One more time, the number, 1-800-892-6477. So, Dean, you said the magic words, political football, and boy, folks, in the fall of 2014, we'll be talking a lot more about elections. But activity is already picking up. Norma, this week, former State Senator Jim Rubins made it official.
Yes, Jim has ran for governor and lost in a primary to Jay Lucas, who then lost to Jean Shaheen. I think it was her second term. So he's been around a while. Most recently, his was very, very visible in his fight against casino gambling, the Coalition Against Expanded Gambling. I think he certainly has a history that his opponents will be able. It's not like he's had this tremendous voting record recently, but he certainly has a history that people will point to. One of the things that another person who might come in is Karen Testerman, who is founder of Cornerstone Action, which is a very, very conservative group that is anti-gay marriage, anti-tax increases across the spectrum. And Jim, on the other hand, has always been pro-choice. So that would prove to be an interesting primary.
Also someone who was involved in climate change and combating climate change with the Union of Concerned Scientists. So more on the moderate or liberal end of the Republican Party, Norma.
Well, I think he's had his issues with the Republican Party over the years. So he's a very, very unique person. I think he will have unique stands on things that are not necessarily what you would consider to be traditional Republican in any sense of the word.
Yeah. So, Dean, here you have Karen Testerman on the conservative end and Jim Rubins. You don't want to pigeonhole someone, but definitely taking some moderate positions on certain issues. Is there anybody who's going to fill in the middle in this possible Republican primary to defeat U.S. Senator Jean Shaheen?
You know, there has been some talk about Charlie Bass, a former congressman from the 2nd Congressional District, Republican, getting in as well. It's not clear if that's actually going to happen. Karen Testerman, I mean, she may run. She's run for statewide office before and has not done particularly well. Jim Rubins has kicked off his campaign. He is full speed ahead if you've been listening to him over the last few days. And his strategy essentially is going to be to link Shaheen very closely as being complicit in Syria, Obamacare, increasing federal debt. I mean, his argument basically is that Jean Shaheen has voted to support all of these, and she has to be held accountable for a variety of issues that may not be popular. You know, he's even saying that, look, the anti-war wing of the Democratic Party is very unhappy with Jean Shaheen for voting in favor of the resolution in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. So, you know, he has significant personal resources. I think the Senate campaign between Jean Shaheen and John Sununu the last time around cost somewhere between $15 to $18 million.
Wow, in a small state like New Hampshire.
Yes, there's going to be a lot of outside money. Rubens talks about this being a national election. He's willing to self-fund. So he'll be competitive, but you know we'll see. It's going to be a tough road. He's happy that some of the new polling we can talk about has him at around 33% against Shaheen. He actually thinks that's pretty good at this point.
Well, and speaking of 2014 and polling, Dean, there was some new polling out on 2014, and Ben, you reported on this. First off, whose poll is it? Because some polls are better than others.
Well, so this is a company called Public Policy Polling, or PPP, and PPP is a Democratic firm, and that's important to note. That said, they are usually considered pretty accurate. They had pretty accurate polls, state-level polls during the 2012 election, presidential election. But they have been criticized by some Republicans as having a lean. That said, the poll had pretty good news for Shaheen, had pretty good news for Governor Hassan, both of whom will be on the ballot in 2014, showing them leading all the potential Republican opponents. Now, most of those folks aren't well-known in the state, and that's clear from the poll. They have very low numbers of people who say they even know enough about them, Jim Rubins and all these other folks, to have an opinion about them.
That's why they're getting started early, right,
that's
Ben?
I mean,
takes a while.
That's why they're getting early. That's why they're raising money. That's why because Jean Shaheen's going to be pretty strong in the next election. She's going to have money, and she's got a base of popularity, and that means that you have to get started early.
Norma?
I think these polls are way too early, but I think one of the reasons you do polls this early, well, there are two reasons probably. One is to kind of a temperature check, but the other is to go out, like Ben is saying, and get people like us to say, look, Jean Shaheen's doing really well. Maggie Hassan is doing really well. And it's kind of the scare factor. Let's scare the other people away, and we'll scare their money away. They can't possibly do it. It's way too early. I mean, we're, what, a year and a half away from this election, or a year over a year? I mean, it's way, way too early to say this is definitive.
Yeah, go ahead, Ben.
Absolutely. And I think it's interesting that the two most well-known potential Senate candidates against Jean Shaheen, Scott Brown from Massachusetts and Charlie Bass, both did a lot better than the other potential Republican candidates in that poll. Charlie Bass was 10 points back. Scott Brown was only 4 points back.
And they haven't even announced, though.
No.
They're not even officially in.
Seems real questionable whether Scott Brown will get into it, but Charlie Bass is a real potential candidate.
Well, I want to turn now, folks, to two Manchester stories that made big news this week. And joining us for more on that is Ted Seifer. He's City Hall reporter for the New Hampshire Union Leader. Ted, thanks a lot for taking the time out for us.
Sure.
Well, first I want to ask you, Ted, about the new Common Core standards for public schools. Now, these are being implemented across the state, but in Manchester, you seem to be getting some backlash. Ted, what's going on?
Yeah, opponents of the state standards have made Manchester a battleground for implementing the curriculum, or I should say the standards. Manchester, for some reason, has been slower than other districts to adopt the standards. And so that's just now really happening. And opponents of the standards have been turning out at school board meetings. There was a big forum at St. Anselm College this last week. So, it's just sort of become a front line. The battle.
Well, I understand from reading your reports, Ted, the school board this week postponed a decision on whether to implement these. Is that right?
That's right. At this point, you know, there's a new superintendent. She really wants to move forward in aligning the curriculum, as they say, to the new standards. And opponents have submitted a long list of questions that they want answered. And I think the school board just wants to make sure that it gives a fair hearing to people who have concerns about the standards. It does look like the district is going to move forward with these changes.
Also in Manchester, Ted, primary elections this week. Manchester and a couple other cities around the state do hold elections in this off year. Obviously, the big race in the Queen City is for mayor. So who are the main candidates there, Ted?
Well, now it's we had our primary on Tuesday, and now it's between Mayor Ted Gatsis and Alderman Patrick Arnold. He surprised a lot of people. He had a much stronger showing on Tuesday than I think a lot of people expected. He won 40% of the vote, and he was pretty much a no-name about 6 months ago. He's from out of town. He's a two-term alderman, a young guy, 30 years old. But a lot of people are taking notice of him now.
Well, and is Manchester's race for mayor a Democrat-Republican thing, or is it supposed to be nonpartisan?
It is technically nonpartisan, but that's sort of in quotes. Everyone knows that Ted Gatsis is a Republican and Patrick Arnold is a Democrat, and you know they sort of each have their parties and their loyal constituencies backing them.
All right. Ted, thank you very much. We'll probably check in with you later on down the line once that election is settled. Thank you for being with us this morning.
Absolutely. Thanks.
That's Ted Seifer, City Hall reporter for the New Hampshire Union Leader. The number for you to join us on the exchange with our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. We're following up on some of the big news stories of the week, including the health insurance exchanges and all the conversation about that. We've also been getting a political update on next year's congressional elections and looking at some new numbers on poverty and wealth in the Granite State. You can join us. We'd love your thoughts, questions, comments at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, Facebook is NHPR Exchange. And just to wrap up our political segment, if we could, Dean Spiliotis, in the first congressional district, Dan Innes resigned as dean of the business school at UNH to really look seriously at a run on the Republican side for the first congressional district, the seat held now by Carol Shea Porter. Now, we've talked about Mr. Innes before, but just give us a refresher, Dean, who he is, what he might bring to the table.
Yeah, well, an interesting case. Obviously, as you mentioned, he was a UNH dean, is now, as you said, resigned. He is Republican. He's gay. He's married. That would be a very different type of Republican nominee than what we've traditionally had in the past. Frank Ginto is much more conservative. This particular district really has seemed to kind of fluctuate with kind of the larger partisan trends in the state, which is typically true of House seats much more so than Senate seats, There certainly will be an opportunity if it turns out to be a Republican year for Republicans to take that seat back. So, this would be an opportunity. We've talked in a number of shows about the need for the Republican Party in the state to kind of rebuild its bench, bring in some fresh candidates. This might be exactly the kind of opportunity they need to shake things up a little bit.
You know, Norma, I was reading a commentary by a longtime observer of New Hampshire politics, and I apologize, I can't think of who it was, but this person said, boy, here we are talking about, Frank Ginta again, Charlie Bass again, Carol Shea Porter again, Jim Rubens again, although he's been out of elective office for a while. And this person said, why can't we get something new going on here in the Granite State?
Well, it takes an awful lot of commitment and time. I mean, look at what happened with Jeb Bradley. He was considering a run for U.S. Senate, had some serious illnesses in his family, had to step back and think, can I manage this? I have to raise money. I have to put all this time and effort into it. And I think, secondly, in this day and age, it's brutal. I mean, to be out there as a candidate, people go back, they'll find your blog posts, they'll find anything you thought of when you were in high school. I mean, and they'll bring it forward. And there are already operations on both sides, of the Senate, of the House, whatever, looking to find what they can find. They do this every 2 years. And so you have to really put yourself out there and be willing to take it on the chin for things.
All right. Well, we will talk a lot more after a short break. Some of the stories I want to follow up on with you in our next segment has to do with the new women's prison that is finally going to be built. Also, some emergency spraying for Tripoli in West Nile in southeastern New Hampshire. And I'll ask you all very quickly about a new lawsuit concerning fishing regulations. All that coming up, so stay with us.
This is NHPR 939. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup, the aftermath of the Navy Yard shooting, the Fed unexpectedly continues its stimulus campaign. Then the Obama administration prepares for a high-level meetings with Iran's new president. All coming up on the Diane Rehm Show.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from UR members, and support also comes to us from Comcast Business, partnering with businesses of any size to provide scalable technology solutions that keep pace with growth and success. More business.comcast.com. And LaValle Middleton Building Supply, offering exterior portfolio siding to rejuvenate your home's exterior with installation available. Information at lavalleys.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Monday in The Exchange, with epic floods in Colorado, we'll look at what New Hampshire's doing to prepare for the floods of the future. Find us on Facebook at NHPR Exchange to join the conversation ahead of the show. And then be sure to join us Monday morning, live at 9. Today in The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. We're following up on some of the major headlines of the week, and we'd love to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send a short email to exchange at nhpr.org or post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. And a couple more stories that I wanted to follow up on with all of you, but we keep getting emails coming in, Ben Lubsdorf, on these exchanges, these healthcare marketplaces that we talked about at the beginning of the show. I think that people have a lot of questions about these and just how they're going to work. Here's our latest email. This is from Glenn in Deerfield. He says, why is Anthem the only insurer participating in the exchange? Glenn, it's a great question.
Well, and I think that Lisa Gerton said this, the president of Anthem, when she met with the state senators, which is that surprised them as well. They won't be the only one for long. In 2015, Harvard Pilgrim says that they'll be entering the exchange with their own plans. But for now, Anthem is the only one. And they said it, you know, takes a long time. As Lisa Gerton explained, it takes a lot of effort to put these plans together, make them affordable, and that Anthem can, of course, draw on the National Blue Cross Blue Shield network for expertise and for the ability to put that together. So I think they were in a pretty strong position to begin with to participate in this.
Is Harvard Pilgrim a regional provider or a national provider? Anybody know about that? I know Anthem does have that big national resource base of expertise and money and so forth. So, all right, well, more coverage of these exchanges for sure we'll have to do because people do have a lot of questions. Norma, go ahead and jump in.
One quick thing is that I think people don't realize that there's so many unknowns. Are you going to get every person who has tremendous health problems and it's going to cost your network a lot of money? So I think that there are some people are kind of waiting in the wings.
All right. Norm, I wanted to ask you about a story that came up this week in the midst of talking about New Hampshire's pretty positive employment picture. The fishing industry continues to struggle. New Hampshire joined a lawsuit with Massachusetts this week over fishing regulations. What's going on there, Norma?
Well, they try to assess what the health of the fishing, the fisheries are, and they set these limits on catches.
They meaning the federal government.
The federal government. And they try to balance it out with the economics of the fishing industry. And there's some concern that they went too far the other way. I think I saw a quote, it may have been from Kelly Ayotte, saying, could your business stand an 87% cut?
Wow.
Well, I don't know if it's that deep, but for some, it is quite sizable. And I think New Hampshire's concerned about these small fishing boats. You know, the fishing industry can be these huge trawlers, or you can have, you know, the lobster-sized boats. I mean, so the concern is that you're going to kill off an industry by taking away their livelihood. It takes a certain amount of insurance and money just to get the boat on the water and keep it there.
Well, and this latest regulation comes after years and years of cutbacks, so I know they're feeling the pain in the industry. Go ahead, Ben.
Well, and the brief that the state attorney general's office filed to join this lawsuit by Massachusetts, which dates from several months ago, notes that New Hampshire's fishing industry isn't as big as Massachusetts is. It relies much more on smaller fishermen. But they also know that it has a very long history. The brief actually cites John Smith coming up to New England in the early 1600s to look for gold and failing that to fish.
Wow. And so, well, and at that point, fish was gold because there were so many of them.
Right.
And that's the federal government side, right, Dean? It's that, you know, look, we feel your pain, but if we don't put serious regulations in place, there won't be any fish left for you anyway. That's always been their argument.
That's right, and this is being done essentially through the U.S. Department of Commerce, and I think the figure I saw was like a 77% reduction in catch limits. You know, this is I grew up on the water on the East Coast, and we had this same issue with clam beds, the clamming industry, and, you know, having to leave beds alone for a certain number of years, and there were a number of people for whom clamming was their livelihood. And so this is sort of an ongoing battle. And the balance, as Norma said, is between environmental considerations and sustainable fishing. And the argument that New Hampshire is making, as is Massachusetts, is that these new regulations throw that out of balance.
I wanted to ask all of you, Ben, you first, about a story that had a lot of people smiling this week, and that is a contract finally signed to build a new women's prison. Many politicians said this was very badly needed. How come, Ben?
Well, the current women's prison in Goffstown is a terrible facility. Pretty much everyone agrees on that. It's inadequate to the needs of the prisoners. And the female prisoners there don't get the same services, access to the same programs as male prisoners.
And there was a lawsuit about that, right?
They filed last year seeking a class action lawsuit against the state on that. And I think that's what prompted the state to really make a push on this. They have been talking for many years about building a new prison, $38 million in the new capital budget that was signed into law this summer. And as you said, this week the executive council approved a $2.4 million design contract for it. Now they still need to build the thing. Construction won't begin until 2015 on the prison, which will be in Concord, 224 beds, expandable to 350. But now that they have a company on board to design it, This thing's starting to get some momentum.
Yeah, and I got to ask you this, Ben. You know, as a New Hampshire person, I did read your coverage and think, well, why did they give it to a Maine company? Why not a New Hampshire company?
Well, this company is SMRT Incorporated, based in Portland, Maine, and they have apparently a great deal of experience in building what they call their justice portfolio, police stations, jails, and prisons. They built the women's prison in Maine, and they built four of New Hampshire's county jails, including the Merrimack County Jail that opened just in 2005. I think that I talked to some folks in Merrimack County who were involved in that project, and they said they were pretty happy with the way SMRT dealt with that. So I think the state was looking at them not only because of their experience in this field, but also their experience specifically in building facilities for women.
In New Hampshire, too. It sounds like they've got some experience there. Norma, I know you've covered this for a long time. There's long, long, long been talk about this women's prison.
It's been the subject of so many studies, and they never did anything until they got sued. But, you know, they're going to put it on the grounds of where the men's prison is in Concord, sort of in the back. And that way they can use some of the same buildings that the men use for some of these programs. And that's what they mean by some savings or efficiencies. But I find it interesting that we had to put it in Concord, because when we talked about it over all these years, they talked about putting it in Manchester. Manchester didn't want it. We talked about, well, where are we going to put it? Maybe Laconia. And they were like, no, we don't want it there. So we end up in Concord again.
Yeah, and that's a problem for some Concord politicians. Maybe a problem is overstating it, Dean, but there were some concerns expressed that, you know, when people get out of prison, sometimes they don't have jobs. Sometimes it creates more of a strain on the city's social welfare services. But those who favor building this new prison said, no, most of these women, when they get out, will just go back to their home communities. It's not like they're going to take up the new residence in Concord.
That's right. And I think, you know, for me, the key arguments that have really dominated discussion here is the quality of the existing facility in Goffstown and the kind of inability for the state to meet its obligations to provide these different resources to women. And this argument that Norma mentioned, that if you build the facility right behind the men's prison, they can share classrooms. They can share some medical facilities, different types of emergency facilities, and basically that's how you reduce the cost to make
and
it
personnel
affordable.
Too. Let's personnel, say someone's
sure.
doing a program for men, then they
right.
can just
education, training, everything can be done in conjunction or on a rotational basis.
Sure, Ben.
Well, and going back to what Norma said about other communities didn't want this prison, and now it's ended up in Concord. The state owns the land; they can put it there, and it's important to note that Concord doesn't get a say.
The state owns the land.
The state owns the land, and there's a state law that says that when the state government builds something for the state government, it doesn't need to go through planning or zoning approval. So if a private developer came in and said, I want to build something in Concord, they have to go to the zoning board, the planning board. If it requires a zoning change, to the city council, the city gets to consult on this project. They get to offer input. But in the end, Concord doesn't really get a say in this. The state has made clear that they want to work with the city on this and address the concerns that some officials have. But in the end, the state gets to call the shots.
Yeah, I think that over the years, there's been more acceptance in Concord than, say, some of the other locations that we've discussed. I mean, Laconia, they own the grounds there on the side of the old Laconia School. But there's just this community resistance.
Yeah. All right. Well, a couple other stories that I did want to follow up with you guys. And Dean, let's move to southeastern New Hampshire. And more towns there spraying for mosquitoes this week, after about a dozen batches tested positive for Triple E, about a dozen, this is roughly, for West Nile. How unusual is this spraying, Dean? Or has this become sort of an annual event in New Hampshire?
Well, we've talked about this, the fact that it seems like this the coverage of West Nile and Triple E is typically significant from roughly August through mid-October every year now. We do have emergency spraying each year. This year, it's currently, as you referenced, in Sandown, Hampstead, Derry, Raymond, and Newtown. The state has tested 4,200 batches of mosquitoes. You always see those little visual pictures of a clump of mosquitoes in a petri dish. and 13 of the batches have tested positive. You know, the issue is that this is Triple E in particular, but both are potentially fatal. The government wants the state government wants to stay on top of it with the spraying. But we have noted that it does seem to get a lot of coverage every year in comparison to some other things that may be problematic as well. But, yes, there is emergency spraying, not unusual this time of year.
Norma. Well, I just wanted to jump in and say people should always wear protection because birds fly, and it's the birds that get infected. The birds fly, the mosquitoes bite. You know, it gets transferred. So Even if it's found in one part of the state, that's no guarantee that a bird didn't fly into your neighborhood.
Yeah, mosquitoes do travel.
And they bite the birds that travel.
Right.
And then bite the birds.
It typically does seem to be when this does occur in sort of the southern tier to southeastern part of the state.
Well, and that's an area where a 20-year-old woman died in 2005. So, you know, we can say, Tripoli, you know, it's not as big a problem or whatever. But someone did die from that less than a decade ago. So a little scary there. Dean, I did want to ask you about the 75th anniversary that many towns were observing this week of the Hurricane of 38. Some great interviews in the local press with older Granite Staters who remember this. This was huge, Dean. Just remind us how startling it was. I'm not saying that you were there.
No,
but
and it is interesting to hear these sort of firsthand accounts of what it was like. Yeah, the 21st, which is tomorrow, I believe, is the 75th anniversary of this great New England hurricane. It was a Category 3 hurricane, 125-mile-an-hour winds, moved across the state at 70 miles an hour. Hundreds of people were killed, particularly in the southern part of New England, really took a beating. And it took down a lot of trees, did a lot of damage, altered the terrain for, you know, an extended period of time. What's interesting to me is you think about the differences in technology today and kind of the ability, the coverage that leads up to a hurricane actually moving into an area compared to what it probably was in 1938, which would have been, you know, the radio or some other means of emergency communication. It's a lot harder. You know, construction methods were different. Emergency techniques and services were different, you end up with a higher human toll than you would typically have in a hurricane today.
And now it's hard to stay uninformed.
That's right. You can't get away from the coverage even. And then a lot of times, you know, sometimes it's significant, as we've had in recent years. Other times it ends up not being anything.
Norma?
I mean, I will never forget seeing after, I think it was Hurricane Andrew, a demonstration of what 100-mile-per-hour wind could do with a 2x4 and send it right through a building.
Sure.
And that can send it right through you. So people who say, I'm going to write it out, I'm going, okay.
Yeah, and the stories have just been great. Again, hearing from people who remember the storm from when they were, you know, 5 years old, 10 years old. So here's an email that just came in from Christopher commenting on our political conversation earlier. Christopher says, I think it's exciting to see Republicans like Brad Cook, Jim Rubens, Dan Innes as potential contenders in 2014. They don't fit the usual mold, and it won't be easy for the Democratic Party to typecast them as, quote, out-of-touch right-wing extremists as they usually do. If these three run, it will be an interesting year. Christopher, thanks for chiming in, and love your thoughts there, Ben Lubsdorf.
Well, you're right. These are three candidates who have either said they're running or talking about running who would be different kinds of candidates. Brad Cook, for example, says he's looking at a race for governor. He is a moderate Republican and says he wouldn't take the pledge. He isn't saying he's calling for an income tax, but he says that it would be silly for him to tie his hands ahead of time. And, of course, Dan Innes, more moderate. Jim Rubens, more moderate on some of these social issues. I think the real question that we'll see unfold over the next year or so is, will these folks win the primary? In order to get to the general election, they need to get through a primary first. And in an off year, a midterm election, it's possible that the Republican primary electorate is going to be a little more conservative than it would be otherwise. So it'll be interesting to see. On the other hand, there probably won't be any contested primaries on the Democratic side, so independents might be flocking to the Republican races.
Interesting. Yeah, what do you think, Dean? Thanks, Christopher, for the email.
That's exactly the issue. It's the primary. And depending, obviously, on who the players are, what do you think the chances are that a Republican who won't take the pledge is going to get through a Republican primary? It's possible, but not necessarily likely. So, you know, the issue, again, is the Republican Party thinking about kind of, you know, the way in which the primary here in the state drives the types of candidates who become nominees, and then where they need these nominees to be in the general election, which is kind of, you know, more sort of center-right, center-left, get that big group of independents. We did not see that with Ovid LaMontagne when he ran for governor the last time around, and he ended up losing by 12 points. But there is also, you know, we've kind of gone through this list of the usual suspects, Charlie Bass, Frank Ginta, Jim Rubens, a little bit different, but he's been around for a long time as well. I think the party has some work to do in recruiting these new types of candidates.
Well, I think Ben hit on it. I mean, it's a part. We have a state divided in thirds. We have a third Democratic, a third Republican, and about a third undeclared. So during a primary, if you only have the activists turn out and they tend to be more conservative, typically the Dan Inneses lose. So you end up in the general election and the state is more moderate and the Ovid LaMontagnes lose. So the Republican Party is right now, I think, kind of divided into sort of the far right Tea Party. Then you have sort of the moderates who may or may not be
have a role. I mean, they've been kind of pushed aside in recent years. And then you have kind of the establishment party, which is trying to control things and pick nominees. And then you have the people on the bottom who are saying, don't pick my nominee for me. And you end up with this kind of churn.
All right. Well, I agree with Christopher. It's going to be interesting. So we know that for sure. Norma, real quickly, I love to end these Friday News Roundups by asking you guys what you're going to be following next week. What are some of the major stories?
I'm going to be following my house. I'm on vacation.
You'll be on vacation. All right. When you get back?
When I get back, I probably will be picking up on Medicaid expansion, which has to have its report filed by the 15th of October.
Right. Big story as New Hampshire decides which way to go with this. Ben, how about you?
Well, we've been talking a lot about 2014, but 2016 is just around the corner for the presidential race. Next Friday, Emily's List, the group that fundraises for pro-choice Democratic women, will be in Manchester for a Madam President town hall. They're doing these events to promote the idea that there should be a woman president. Governor Haslam will be there, Senator Shaheen will be there, and former Michigan Governor Jennifer Granholm. So that should be interesting.
Okay. Dean?
Looking to see if Jim Rubens is going to get any traction on Jean Shaheen. She hasn't really had anybody hitting her hard so far. He's come out swinging. A couple of huge issues coming up in Congress over the next few weeks. The continuing move by Republicans to defund Obamacare, link it to government shutdown, debate over raising the debt ceiling. Some really big votes that it'll be interesting to see how our congressional group of legislators does.
All right. Absolutely. Dean, thank you very much for being here. Appreciate it.
Sure. My pleasure, Laura.
Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University. Norma Love, have a nice vacation. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Laura.
Norma Love, State House reporter for the Associated Press. And Ben Loomstorff, thank you very much for being here. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Ben Loomstorff, staff reporter at the Concord Monitor, covering New Hampshire and state government. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producers are Ellen Grimm and Faith Meixel. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
Next week on The Exchange, with biblical floods in Colorado and some major ones in New Hampshire's recent past, we'll see how prepared we are for the floods of the future. Then Dartmouth professor Charles Whelan on his book Naked Economics, Undressing the Dismal Science, and Granite State higher education leaders address concerns over college affordability amid new scrutiny from the White House. Email us at nhpr.org and join us all next week for The Exchange, every morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
Diane Rehm Show and the Friday News Roundup next at 10 on NHPR, where support comes from UR members and from Bedford Falls Assisted Living and Memory Care, offering a monthly Alzheimer's Caregivers Book Club. A copy of the book, Connecting the Dots, may be reserved by calling 471-2555. And Waste Management, with a reminder, new energy efficient CFL bulbs contain mercury and need to be recycled properly. Details on bulb recycling at thinkgreenfromhome.com.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO, Concord, 89.1.
WEVS, Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH, Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN, Keene, 90.7.
WEVC, Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ, Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF, Colebrook, 90.3.
WEVQ, Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
Good morning, it's 10 o'clock.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Steve Roberts of the George Washington University, sitting in today for Diane Rehm. Authorities in Washington are investigating whether a workplace dispute was behind the shootings at the Navy Yard. A Navy subcontractor murdered 12 people before being shot and killed by police. House Republicans approve a plan to cut funding for food stamps by nearly $40 billion. And House Republicans also try once again